Okay, without further ado, questions and answers of Rabbi Susie Stone, and I invite Rabbi to ask us as well. Let's make it a dialogue. Rabbi?
So I've been asked if you have a question just to come to the mic, and you know, I also, you know, obviously you can ask questions, but I'd like to know if you want to share something that, you know, struck you or that you learned, or just a sentence or two, that just so I can have some feedback on what's new and interesting for you guys. Go ahead.
I was intrigued by the notion that, you know, God has compassion more than God has love. Mm. And I don't know the Bible too well, so I'm not going to go. But it is my impression that in the Psalms, mm-hmm. it's very much a lover or a beloved. Mm-hmm. And there's a mystical aspect to yeah. the Psalms that definitely has this love. So I would like Great. You to speak to that. And also of the mystical aspect of in your faith, you know.
Yeah. It's a really good question. And it's right on target. There's a notion in all of sort of like rabbinic thought that what you were saying, that God is sort of a partner, right? And God is, especially in the Song of Songs, even more so than the Psalms, in the Song of Songs and Shir HaShirim, this notion that God and the people of Israel are like a beloved. So there is and I would say that it's less that, for me, what this connotes is that it's not that God is loved, is that we're in a loving relationship, right? So the whole idea of God and the Israelites is that we have a relationship, not that God is love. It is a loving relationship, but it's different, right? So we're not defining God as love. But there are certainly moments where in our scriptures all over the place that says God, you know, you shall love God with all your heart and all your mind. I mean, that's one of our primary commandments in the Via Hafta. So we are commanded to love. But again, God, in throughout the scriptures and throughout the Psalms for sure, God loves us in return. But again, it's a relational form of love. It's not God emblemizes love or, you know, that kind of notion. That's sort of my, you know, and you might ask another rabbi and they might say, yeah, God is love. It's just nothing. It's not that it's wrong. It's just not necessarily how we talk about it. Yeah. Just very little bit nuanced. Yeah.
On feedback, we had a talk from the Islamic tradition last week, and so one thing I was struck by was he used the same word you did, which I won't try and pronounce.
Begins
with an R.
Yeah, yeah.
But meaning womb, and right. spoke exactly from the same perspective right. that I think that you did today. The other thing about his talk, and you touched on it, so it's, if you want to comment further, is he tended to use compassion and mercy like constantly as a joined phrase. Mm-hmm. And earlier when you were speaking, I thought you distinguished
yeah.
between them and whether you wanted to comment on that first.
Sure, sure. In Hebrew, there's, it is a little bit, I mean, I think there's gradations of that. Because I think in sort of like everyday prayer life, we do kind of conflate mercy and compassion. But if you're going to, you know, spend time, you know, in a spiritual book club, it's worth the while to think about the differences of them. So in Hebrew, rachamim is most associated with compassion. And then there's a Hebrew root, chamal, which is more closely associated with mercy. And basically, chamal is very similar to what I was saying before about mercy. It's to pardon or to spare. And it's something that a sort of superior can do for an inferior. It's the power dynamic is back in there. So that's the idea. When we're praying during the high holidays, we say chamal aleinu. You know, when we say avinu malkeinu chamal aleinu. So it means to spare us, to have mercy. So it's this notion that we might not deserve it, but we're asking for it. Versus compassion, like I said, is in of more of a bilateral relationship. There's not this notion of, you know, asking for something you don't deserve. It's the notion that because we're all sort of, you know, from the womb, we should treat each other as equals, versus this notion of chamal or mercy is more about asking for grace. You know, how we say it in Christian tradition, often we say grace, so very similar to mercy in Hebrew, or chamal. Does that help? Okay. Yes, Keith.
I'm going to stay here. The mic is eluding me. One thing that really struck me, I don't know where I, in my Catholic background, always seemed like we had to have answers. Maybe from the old catechism days. You better have memorized those answers or sister will get you. But that's always stuck with me, that idea. Uh-huh. I've got to have the answer. But I like this. You know, the faith is a journey, a quest for God. And I love Augustine saying about what you said, if you think you found God, you didn't. That's not it.
Right, right.
So I love that. Thank you.
Yeah, I think there is something innately, thank you for Keith for raising it. I think that's one of the things that when people convert to Judaism, they're like, well, what do I need to know? And I was like, what do you need to ask? You know, and so I think that that's the difference. There is definitely not a catechism or, you know, we have some principles of faith. I noticed it was interesting that I, on your little orange thing up here, or I don't know what color it is. For Judaism, you actually have Maimonides. And it says, the heart's intention is in the measure of all things. Well, Maimonides is an interesting thinker because he's, he comes in the 11th century, and he's a neo-Aristotelian, which means he's a rationalist, hyper-rationalist. And he tried to create a Jewish notion of principles of faith. It's famous. It's called the 13 Principles of Faith. But it didn't, you know, we sing it every Friday and Saturday in our prayers. But if you were to say, ask a Jew, do you believe in these 13 principles? And they say, nah, I don't really know. I'm not sure. We're not going to say, well, you're not Jewish then. Right, so there's nothing that's stuck in the Jewish faith that said you have to subscribe to, you know, these 10 principles or these, you know, I mean, fundamentally, it's, you know, monotheism is the basis of it, and then everything else is sort of up to this notion of awe and wonder and question. Yeah.
Hi, could we ask you to help us understand better a little where you fit in the spectrum of Reformed versus conservative versus whatever?
Sure.
What's the current breakdown of flavors of Judaism today, and where would you...
Yes. I can answer that question. So, you know, you didn't say this, but I would say, you know, 30 to 40% of Jews are consider themselves secular, which means that they don't necessarily attend religious services, but they consider themselves culturally, ethnically, historically Jewish, and, you know, are proud of that, but that don't necessarily affiliate with a denomination. And then there's Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionist, Orthodox, and Ultra-Orthodox. But coming from my perspective, if you were to ask, there's Presbyterian and there's Catholic, and there, I mean, you guys have way more. Just telling you, from somebody who did not grow up Christian, I find it to be very confusing. So we have like 5. We're pretty good. So in terms of just, you know, sort of principles and theology, the ultra-Orthodox is probably what you would imagine, you know, to see on TV if you, you know, see an image of Israel or something like this. So kind of black hat and the long payas, this is the curls, the women who are, you know, fully clothed and won't, you know, have all, you know, they wouldn't show their elbows or anything like that. So that's ultra-Orthodox. Then there's Orthodox, modern Orthodox, which is, you know, they have, they fully believe in full integration into society, and they go to universities, but they follow, their observance is pretty strict to follow the halakha or the law. And then conservative Judaism is sort of in between Orthodox and Reform. And conservative Judaism says that the law is binding, but there's modifications to law because we live in a modern world. So that's kind of how conservative Judaism sees it. Then Reform Judaism says that it's basically that the Jewish law has a vote but not a veto. That's kind of what our ancestors, 200 years ago said. We have to really understand it, and we want to opt into it. But it's not that, like, if you don't do it, you're a bad Jew. You know, if you don't do it, you're not fully Jewish. So, our sort of ancestors of the Reform movement started in about the 1800s in Germany, where they first received emancipation after 1800 years of basically not having full citizenships or rights or be able to own land. And so they, sort of the choice was, if we're fully emancipated but we're not accepted, so do we become Christians, which many of the Jews in Germany did, or, I mean, Moses Mendelssohn being one of the most famous, his grandson being Felix Mendelssohn and became a famous composer, but left Judaism, and many more like him, because, to be accepted was to be Christian in Germany. Or do we try to find a hybrid of sort of being an intellectual, scientific understanding of religion and sort of, kind of changing some of our practices and still being Jewish? So that's how the Reform Movement started. It was a historical dynamic in the, 1800s in Germany for, like I said, the first time in 1800 years of having any kind of even notion of full citizenship. So it was this notion of trying to come up with a compromise. How can we be Jewish but be accepted? And so we sort of became sort of this hybrid model of kind of taking on these modern things, not necessarily wearing the black hat and, having everything be in Hebrew. Like, that's the first time the things were translated into English, into German, into things that we could pray in our vernacular language. So I hope that helps. If you have more specifics, you can...
Where are you?
Oh, where am I personally? The congregation that I work for and that I am a part of is Reform.
Early on, you mentioned from a rabbi, wonder rather than doubt is the root of all knowledge. And I wondered, for my sake, if you would sort of give me an example of what you mean by wonder as compared to doubt.
Okay. Great question. So Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, is responding. He's fled from the Holocaust, and he's responding to a world in which science and rationalism rules. And so everything can be sort of figured out intellectually. And so what he's saying is that there's a huge amount of skepticism that inhabits the scientific world. And so he's trying to say that it's not about skepticism, it's about awe. That you still can have unanswered questions. But doubt is the notion that, I don't know and I'll never know, and therefore why ask the question? So this idea of doubt for him is in direct kind of polemic against the scientific world that's all about answers. So that's what he's setting up. He's setting up this dynamic between the scientific world and the religious world, and that they don't have to be in contradiction. You can still not have answers scientifically but still have a religious faith. That's what he's trying to say. And that, his argument for sure after the Holocaust is that this notion of like hyper-rationalism and science doesn't solve the world's problems. In fact, it probably creates more.
I've been greatly influenced in my own understanding of God by process theology, and mm-hmm. I have a question. What I heard from you was very similar to me, and I'm wondering if you could say something about the question of, does God change?
Mm-hmm. So tell me, before you sit down for a minute, actually tell me, when you say process theology, what do you mean?
I'm thinking about the ways in which God is understood as extremely relational, mm-hmm. and even that we change God, mm-hmm. and God also changes as mm-hmm. time mm-hmm. moves.
Yeah.
That's...
Yeah. So there is a... I'm blinking on the contemporary Jewish thinker. I think it's Harold Schulweis, Rabbi Harold Schulweis, who actually is probably the foremost thinker in Jewish process theology. And so there definitely is a contemporary notion, and I would say probably not... Well, actually, I think in the mystical tradition, you could argue, too, that we affect God, our actions affect God. So there is definitely this notion that we are changing and God is changing and our relationship changes each other. And again, do I ascribe to that? At times, yeah. And I think that that's, for me, it's the constant sort of, there are a lot of things about God's being that I find relevant. So it's not like some people can say, I'm a process theologian and that's my belief in God. But I see a lot of things from different camps, so I can't put myself in a box. But what I think is interesting about process theology, and it didn't strike me until you asked the question, was that in somebody else asked about Jewish mysticism, there is this notion in Jewish mysticism that it's a little bit complicated, but I'll try to explain it simply, which was when God created the world, you know, full of light, the light was too expansive, and that it couldn't be contained in the world as it is. So what did God do? God contracted God's self, and like I said before, this notion of simsum, and made room for the other, and then put the light into small vessels, right? And then the vessels, it still couldn't contain God's light, and they broke, and these shards fell down to the earth, and that our job is to basically, through all good deeds, we repair these broken shards. So every time we do a good deed, we repair a broken shard. But what we're doing is actually repairing God's self. So we're bringing, you know, sort of every time, so it to bring it from like the holy to the profane. If you ever go, how many people have been to the land of Israel? Anyone? Okay. So it won't be effective to the women, to the men who have been there. You might have been asked by a man, Orthodox man, to, you know, ask, are you Jewish? Will you put on our, it's called tefillin. It's the, how do you translate it? It's not a shawl. It's the leather binding that we wear, that men often wear. And the reason being is that they believe that every mitzvah is basically a return of one of those broken shards. So whether it's saying prayers, whether it's washing your hands, whether it's treating somebody nicely, whether it's going to visit the sick, all of those things. So it's interesting because I never thought about process theology in terms of Jewish mysticism, but that might be the origins of process theology in our tradition. I have to go back and read a little more. Oh, yeah, we have here, John.
Rabbi Susie, my question was about mysticism, in fact, and if you might say more historically. I know mysticism is seemingly a common thread with all religions. Mm-hmm. So if you can shed light on that for us.
Thanks. Great. So the truth is we don't know much about early Jewish mysticism. We know that it started probably in the 1st and 2nd century BCE and really picked up in the 2nd century CE. And it really is first, the people who wrote the earliest Jewish books of mysticism were based on the book of Ezekiel and Ezekiel's chariot, if you guys know that imagery. And so this you know, notion of a fiery chariot of God, and what was so profound for the Israelites at the time was that God wasn't static, God wasn't in one place, that God could be in exile with the Jews as well as, you know, in the Holy Land. And that was a huge, huge shift in I would say, world thought, not just Jewish thought. Because there's a time when your God was literally tied to your land. And when you lost a battle with another people, your God lost. And you were acculturated into the new God. I teach this to a lot of my students, which is that the notion of monotheism isn't just that there's no pagans. Is that God can be universal. God's not defeatable when you lose your land. That's a huge, huge, I mean, unbelievable sort of, innovation in world civilization and world thought. So that's first. So that was the Jewish mysticism starts with Ezekiel. And then you have rabbis in the early 2nd century who start to create a practice around it. We don't know much about their practice. We know that they're kind of a little bit crazy, but they would know. We have reports that they would sort of like get into, you know, even kind of you could consider like yogic poses, and then they would stay there and they wouldn't eat and they wouldn't drink, and then you'd have these visual notions, you would have these imageries. But then really it picks up the real height of Jewish mysticism. So it's kind of lost for centuries, because also our Jewish tradition teaches us that you're not really supposed to study Kabbalah or Jewish mysticism until you're 40. Because you have to know the basis of Judaism, of Torah and Mishnah and Talmud, before you can even expect to understand the highest mystical notion. So it kind of got lost and it was passed down in a very elite group of scholars. And then it got picked up again actually in 12th century Spain. And I'm sure, I can't give you the source, but I'm sure that it was highly influenced by Muslim mysticism at that time during Spain. And so this notion, like I said, was that the basis of all mystical thought is what I mentioned before. is that there's this notion of contraction and then these shards that were broken. And all we're trying to do here on earth is to do something called tikkun olam, which you may have heard. It's often translated as social justice, but it actually means healing the world. And how do we heal the world is by bringing light and to repair these broken shards. So in practice, there isn't like, it's hard to talk about Jewish mysticism because now we have, you know, these Kabbalah centers all over the world and it's picking up. And if anyone follows Madonna, you know, she's like Jewish mystic. there's not like a special practice if you're a Jewish mystic. It's not like you do prayers differently or you study different things. A lot of people have taken the Judaism out of Jewish mysticism, which I think is a, you know, if you go, I've studied at the Kabbalah Center and I probably was one of three Jewish people there, which is fine. But the teacher who was wearing a kippah and, you know, wearing the traditional Jewish clothes, he said you don't, you know, there's nothing Jewish about Kabbalah, which I think is a pity, you know, because everything is Jewish about Kabbalah. And like you can't, like I said, you can't really understand Jewish mysticism until you understand the basics. Not to say that everyone, that there are things that can be gleaned from these centers throughout the world, and I think it's great that it's out there. But you can't really detach it from Judaism in a really authentic way. You could glean sort of insight and compassion and things like that, tools for living. But I think it's not very authentic to say it's not related to Judaism.
I got a couple of things. First of all, kind of a throwaway. Moses, I think, was a mystic because of his encounter on Sinai and how it gets related in Exodus.
Yeah.
That's racial memory.
Uh-huh.
But just the very fact, the way they describe this, yes, he had, yeah. It had to have been a mystical thing that he tried to translate into the words of the people.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, the other thing, and my main point is that in the Catholic tradition, Second Vatican Council brought back into consciousness the idea of people of faith being a pilgrim people on a journey that we do not know everything.
Beautiful.
I find it for myself, the more I learn, the less I know. But it is this idea of we are in process.
Yeah.
There is this encounter with the divine. And you mentioned, you know, how does God get voice through us?
Mm-hmm.
God becomes known through ourselves, through people. And by the divine self, there is muteness. We give voice. We give clarity and begin to get little pieces, as you said, the shards.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all we can do.
I do love the notion of pilgrimage people. I'd not heard that term before, but it's beautiful. So thank you for sharing. There is something, you know, in Judaism, I want to speak to that idea of pilgrimage. Our holidays, we have three pilgrimage holidays. We have Sukkot, we have Passover, and Shavuot. And the three times of year where ancient Israelites were commanded to go to Jerusalem and to offer sacrifices. And today we call our holidays Chagim, which comes from the same word that is in Arabic Hajj. You know, when you make Hajj and they go in circles? Well, Chagim and Hajj, they all come from the same Hebrew and Proto-Semitic root of circle. And so this notion that we're constantly in a cycle of learning and sort of this notion of pilgrimage people, I really like, and it speaks to me in that regard. Thank you.
In the Jewish tradition, if you don't speak of God as love, how then do you speak of love as part of the Jewish spirituality?
Yeah, I think that, again, you might encounter Jews, probably, who will speak of God as love, but it's not the prominent, you know, feeling. But like I said before, that we're in a loving relationship. Part of our covenant with God is that we love God and God loves us. So there is absolutely love there. I don't want to say there's the absence of love. It's just the difference, again, is God isn't symbolic of love, but that the relationship is love. Does that make sense?
Do you see as God is a source of that love that is shared in the relationship?
Yes, yes, yes.
Morning.
Good morning.
Pardon me for a brief preamble to frame my question.
No problem.
Formally, I'm a Presbyterian elder, last thing I ever expected to be. I kind of self-identify as Buddhist Christian. Mm-hmm. Most deeply, I consider myself an evolutionary, by which I mean thumbnail that the 14.5 billion year journey of the universe is a journey toward an attempt of the universe to become self-conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And our own moment in that story is one that's both exhilarating and heartbreaking, because now that we're face to face with each other all around the planet, there seems like there's stirrings of a new kind of consciousness emerging out of that. Something really positive, I think. At the same moment that we're on the verge of destroying ourselves,
yes.
And I'm aware of quite a bit of Christian and secular writing pondering these kinds of things, but I have an ignorance about whether there is anything going on within specifically Jewish thought.
Thank you for the question. Yes, there is. And there's probably more than I could list right now, but I'll give you one name that I think is the best person to go to in this regard. He spoke here last November, actually, in Santa Barbara. His name is Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. He just stepped down as the chief rabbi of the UK. And he wrote a book called The Dignity of Difference. Dignity of Difference. And he's written like 20 books in the last 10 years, so you could pick any of his books up and find it to be amazing. But he speaks very, very specifically about the clash of like the positive power of religion versus the destructive voice of fundamentalism. And so that clash, sort of like, if I were to put it into my words, what you're talking about is sort of how religion can grow and increase our tolerance and compassion, and at the same time can make us much more closed-minded and ignorant of one another. And so one of the things that one of the reasons why I became a rabbi is because he wrote, I think a very provocative statement, and I read it probably when I was 24 or 25, and he says that if religion doesn't become a part of the solution, it's going to continue to be a part of the problem. And I would argue that a lot of very smart people, because they're scientific thinking and are leaving religion because it doesn't make sense. Right? They're using this argument of science. How can you prove God, so why be religious? But so one of the reasons why I left the world that I was in of community organizing, and I was thinking about becoming a sociology professor, is because I feel like if we take all of the, you know, smart intellectual people out of religion, we sort of leave it to the fundamentalists. We've lost. Right, we've lost that war. So, you know, and especially as a young person, you know, we're a generation of people that my peers are like, what does religion have to do with my life? I think ultimately it has to do with saving our world. You know, if we cannot learn, I mean, that's not a small project, but if we cannot learn what you guys are teaching about compassion and, you know, intellectual humility and the science of compassion, then religion will ultimately be the source of our destruction. So we need to combat it with enlightenment and dialogue and understanding that, you know, we might not have the answers. We're on a constant journey of pilgrimage. But he's who I would recommend, and he's a brilliant scholar, a brilliant rabbi, Orthodox, Jonathan Sacks. And I would start with the book called Dignity of Difference. Sacks? S-A-C-K-S.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have really enjoyed your lecture and so many what I call golden nuggets. I was very intrigued by what you said about emptying yourself and forgetting yourself and being quiet. I teach a lot of emotional intelligence skills to caregivers, and this is a really huge issue with caregivers because they take care of everybody else except themselves.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering where Judaism stands on this concept of self-compassion.
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. I had somebody who came to me the other day and said, well, I know Judaism teaches us that we should be giving and loving, but, you know, I have somebody in my life who is completely taking advantage of me. So where does that end? And they're actually, one of my favorite teachings is probably the second reason why I became a rabbi, beyond the one I just said, is when I was traveling in northern Israel, I encountered an artist of Jewish mysticism who showed me this image, which basically the two Hebrew letters, and one was black on white, and the other was white on black. If you folded it together, it would become one. And the idea was that, you know, he basically taught that the idea of the messianic age is that we all give as much as we receive and receive as much as we give. And that was the first time I heard about sort of messianism, not because of a person or, you know, it's not an individual. It's all of us trying to equalize how much we give and how much we receive. And so when we're out of whack, when we give too much, we feel resentful. And when we take too much, we're depleting others' resources. So I think especially with caregiving, it's a great sort of Jewish teaching. And that's actually in the Kabbalah. That's actually in Jewish mysticism, that the ultimate form of redemption is when everyone can figure out how we can give as much as we receive. And so if we can do it in our personal relationships, think about we can do it in our communities, and then we can do it in the states, and then we can do it in the world. And so there's this notion of unfolding notion of messianism, because we've learned to be giving as much as we're receiving.
You, in my introduction, the concept of an intersection between Judaism and social justice. Mm-hmm. And maybe from your perspective, how does that look for you and in general?
Great. So there's a huge emphasis in the prophets about social justice. And if you've read the prophets, you know what I'm referring to, and this idea that, you know, it's not the prayer, it's not the sacrifice, it's not the fast that I want. It's that you treat the widow and the orphan and the stranger like, you know, like you should. And so there's this ancient notion of social justice within Judaism. Then there's also, which we read every Yom Kippur, which is the reminder that, you know, you can fast all you want, but if you're not treating humankind right, then you're not really being a religious person. So that's, you know, the basic of it. But then in the Jewish mysticism, there's also this notion I mentioned before of tikkun olam, which is repairing the world, bringing back these holy sparks and making them one. And so there is this notion that it's not just, you know, if I pray, I can bring back the sparks, or if I, you know, do something ritual, I bring back the sparks. It's also every time we have a encounter with somebody where we treat them with compassion and dignity, that we sort of create tikkun olam. So that's the second. The third way I would say is that there is this notion. I would argue that what I realized with my 10 years of community organizing is that there's a lot of really burnt out people in social justice, and myself included. And so, you know, it's sort of like what Gandhi said, you know, you need to be the change that you want to see in the world. And if we're all struggling to do things and we're kind of being martyrs for the cause, we're not actually creating the world we want to live in. And so for me, what brought me to Judaism was this notion of the balance between tikkun olam, which is the repairing of the world, and tikkun hanefesh, which is the repairing of one's soul. And so what I like to tell people when they ask me why I'm a rabbi, because people ask me a lot, is that I believe that in order to change the world, you must change yourself first. And so that's the connection for me between Judaism and social justice. Not, you know, yes, we as Jewish people really do a lot of social action, but also it's the spiritual practice of becoming a better person that I think will ultimately also bring justice to the world. Whether it's the thing I mentioned before about the balance between giving and taking. To me, that is social action. Because you have to know in your personal relationships, we all know we have ones that are out of whack, right? That we give more, that we take more. And so sort of every relationship and every encounter that I have, I think about, well, what's my balance? You know, am I creating equilibrium in the world? And that's how I see sort of on multiple levels, both action and social action that we do, but also spiritual justice is what I like to call it.
We've talked in this group about often about necessary rituals. And one of my favorites in the Jewish tradition is Shabbat. Mm. And I find Shabbat such a meaningful thing to do that, you know, I have a lot of, you know, Gentile friends who practice Shabbat every Friday. And I was wondering if you could describe what that is and how that came about. Sure. And I think we miss that in Christian traditions. We miss the idea of Shabbat.
Mm. Sure. Okay. It's a big question. Not easy to answer. Shabbat is one of the fundamental bases of Judaism, and I'm trying to figure out what's the easiest way to sort of answer that. But the simplest way is this idea, you know, that during creation, you know, God made everything in 6 days, and on the seventh day, God rested and took a breath. And so this idea that if we're created in God's image, that we too shouldn't be so narcissistic to think that we need to be moving every minute of every second. So it was one of the profound moments for me again of sort of why I became more spiritual, more religious, was to realize, like, you know, I was working 60 hours a week and I was writing my to-do list and I never stopped. You know, I was 25 years old, I never stopped. I was always working and I was totally burnt out. And then I read this passage from the Torah. And even in the Hebrew, it connotes that God had done all that God finished all that He had done. And it's like the past. It's like the past particle. Participle. Thank you. The past participle. And I used to teach English as a second language, and I don't remember it anymore, obviously. But the idea of, like, well, the past participle means that there are still things left undone. Right? So it was so fascinating to me, like, who am I to think that if God can rest when there's still things left undone, who am I not to rest? And so it was this permission, it was this cosmic permission to not think so highly of myself and to think that, like, the world will go on without me. And I am commanded to take this day to remember my humility. So that's one thing. That's one aspect of Shabbat. The other aspect of Shabbat is, in the Ten Commandments, we talk about that Shabbat is mentioned twice. And in different books. And the other one is, you shall remember the Sabbath day because you were slaves in Egypt. And that this idea that everyone on Shabbat should rest. You, your servants, your dogs, your animals, everyone should rest on Shabbat because everyone deserves some basic human dignity. So there's two very different kind of notions of why we rest on Shabbat. But that's, you know, one is an ethical humanism. And the other is sort of like cosmic recognition of our smallness. And so those are the two. And then the third element I'll say is this idea of covenant, going back to love, the love question. We're commanded to, the idea of Shabbat is that, you know, it's one of the primary commandments is to keep Shabbat. One of the Ten Commandments is to keep Shabbat. And we do it out of love, that we're in relationship to God. And so there's this notion that, like, you know, Sunday, you know, all the days had a partner except for Shabbat. There's a rabbinic story about this, that Sunday had Monday, Tuesday had Wednesday, Thursday had Friday, but no one had Shabbat. And the rabbis teach that, well, Shabbat belongs to the Israelites, and that's the companion of Shabbat. So God and the Israelites are together on Shabbat as a way to signify that love, as a way to, you know, it's one thing to speak words of love, it's another thing to do, and so that's what Shabbat is for us.
Thank you again for your wonderful presentation and these jewels of wisdom that have dripped down to us. I remember you mentioned earlier the idea of idolatry and the idolatry of ideas. Mm-hmm. In fact, you suggested that is something. And I wonder if you could help expand on this idea of just what it means. I mean, for me, for example, a person who says my non-negotiable ultimate value is so important to me, that's my God. I know people, I think, who, you know, if the last thing in the world they did was to jump into a lifeboat before the tsunami, they wouldn't go without their guns. You know, I don't want to be separated from my guns. And there's other people who have cherished ideas, and they don't want to be separated from them. Maybe you could help us with that. And what does it mean to be? When does something go from being a value to being idolatry?
Right.
Yeah.
It's a good question. I think if it's okay, this might be the last question, and then I'll just say a few words of conclusion. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not sure I can say much more than I said. I mean, that's the only. I'm kind of thinking about what when does
Let me ask you a specific question then. This will get into Judaism.
Okay.
The idea of a Jewish homeland in the eyes of some people is conceivably an idolatrous notion. They would argue, for example, that if God loves you, God spreads you around. Get used to it. And for generations upon generations after the rabbinic, the fall of Jerusalem in AD CDE 70, and the whole rise of rabbinic Judaism and the spreading out of the Jewish people all over the world, one could see that as a great gift to the world.
Right.
And so then what about this idea, it's my homeland, right or wrong, you know?
Sure. So I think that, sort of what you said about God spreading out God's people, I think it's a really important notion that the Reform Movement, again, picked up in the early 1800s in Germany. And the early Reformers were not a huge proponent of sort of back to the land, back to Israel, back to propagating that land as an Israelite country. But you also have to understand it in its historical context. In 1803, Napoleon called a Jewish Sanhedrin, a Jewish law of court, and asked about 100 questions of, well, who are you loyal to, and whose law are you following, and will you have more than one wife? And if, you know, if France goes to war, are you going to join our army or are you going to flee? And so there's this notion in early in Western European history that you really couldn't subscribe to the belief that Israel was the homeland because you would be persecuted and pushed out. It was the first time that we actually had citizenship, so we didn't want to sacrifice it by believing that Israel was the true homeland. So, but things changed dramatically after the Holocaust. And so, you know, I'm going to answer it from a geopolitical, and then I'll answer it from a spiritual. Or maybe I'll be vice versa. This idea of Israel right or wrong is something I certainly do not subscribe to. I believe that, you know, we are held to a higher standard, and some of the things that we do in our homeland are not right. And that's okay. Every country, one could argue that there are a lot of American policies. We don't have a government right now. That's not very right. You know, I just heard yesterday we have 4 million veterans who are going to be out of, you know, basically have no pension for the month of November. And I thought to myself, why wasn't that what people were yelling about before the shutdown? Because if people thought about our veterans, they would never have a shutdown. And it's sacrilege that we don't have the government right now. So what I want to say is that there is, for me, there's two answers. The spiritual realm of what you're saying is a sense of, you're right. It's not necessarily we have to have a homeland or this notion of how people have made land into an idol. I would agree with you. But the geopolitical answer is that I would argue is that it beyond spiritual, that for the years of millennium of persecution, if we didn't sort of, there was a long time in Jewish history. And this actually goes back to the book a little bit. There's a long time in Jewish history that Jews felt humility, that we weren't supposed to direct our fate. That God, if God wanted to save us, God would save us. And that's how we endured, you know, 1500 to 1800 years of persecution. Like, we were the God's chosen people because we felt like if God didn't choose us, definitely no one else is choosing us. Right, and so people, I often get into conversations about chosenness and interfaith dialogue, and I just want to say I think chosenness is a mechanism of survival, and that for at least how it becomes after 70, that chosenness isn't, because it doesn't really appear that much in the Torah. It becomes much more prominent in rabbinic thought, and I know I'm going on a little bit of a divergent, but this is a good wrap up. So this idea of sort of the necessity for a political state, and this idea that basically, you know, it started with the Dreyfus Affair in France, where for you know, Herzl basically realized that, you know, we could be given citizenship, but unless we had a land of our own, we would never be treated as equals, ever. And so that notion was created in the height of nationalism. Right, and now we're sort of in this more post-national, you know, sort of post-modern world, And so the question of do we need Israel, it's much more in the mindset. But when Israel and Herzl started to create the Zionist dream, we were in the height of nationalist philosophy. And so this notion of, you know, being treated like all other nations would only happen if we had a land. So yes, I agree in some respects that the land has become an idol, but I also fundamentally believe that there is an incredible, if not fundamental, protection that we receive because of the land of Israel. And so I wouldn't say we just can be everywhere. I personally think that it is important to have it. I also think we need to hold ourselves to a higher standard. So,
thank you.
You're welcome.